Our speaker today is the writer and editor Tanya Cassell. Inspired in part by T.S. Eliot's poem Journey of the Magi, Tanya will explore the graces and challenges of transformation. Tanya has been a writer and editor for 30 years, published in magazines and books internationally. Her nonfiction, fiction, poetry, and radio work have been recognized in many awards. She's a writing coach and book doctor. She leads online and in-person writing seminars and retreats. She holds a master's in transpersonal psychotherapy and is an alumnus of the Christian Contemplative Living School for Action and Contemplation. Longtime Zen Buddhist practitioner, Tanya is senior teacher and mentorship director for Sage Institute's online meditation and mindfulness leader training program. Dang, girl, you got a whole lot of cool stuff going on. Take it away. I'm going to make you larger.
Thank you, larger. Thank you, Jenny. It's all just the old identity, isn't it? It's all just the old identity. Thank you, Jenny. And thank you for letting me. Am I coming across okay? Loud enough?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you for letting me call in by Zoom from home. My husband, Sean, who many of you know, has had asthma, his lung compromised since a child, and also has immune issues. So we have to just be super careful. We're just not doing indoor gatherings. So it's really lovely to be able to do this with you and see so many faces from around the country and the world. And it would be lovely if anybody who was not showing their face felt they could gussy up and go live so I could see you, because that is just so nice to see everyone's face and feel that sense of community, only if you're comfortable. Hey. So yes, my talk is about epiphany, awakenings and rebirth, but especially inspired by the poem Journey of the Magi by T.S. Eliot. And the symbolism in that poem that I see, not just for epiphany as in the big epiphany, but also for the everyday journey, the everyday pilgrimage of our own lives. So January the 6th was epiphany. And epiphany points to the day when the Magi arrived to visit the tiny Christ child in the stable in Bethlehem, in the Western church. That's what epiphany means. And epiphany in the Greek origin actually means manifestation or appearance, especially a divine manifestation. So what's important about this particular visit of the Magi to the Christ child was that they were Gentiles. They were not part of the Jewish community. They came from the East, is what we know, which we think was probably Persia, modern day Iran. So they were outsiders of the community and they were Gentiles. So the important part here is that the divinity of God incarnate in this tiny, fragile baby Jesus is being revealed first to the Gentiles, to the outsiders. That's in Matthew, in the Gospel of Luke. We have the story of the shepherds. And again, shepherds were outsiders. They were poor. They were, you know, they often weren't married men. They were kind of lower in status in the community. Again, they were among the first to see this new life, this new Christ, this new hope. So this speaks very much to the fact that this message of hope and the new Christ consciousness that was being revealed in this epiphany, in this divine manifestation, was open to everyone. It's not just people of a certain tribe. It's not just the rich people. It's not just the insiders. This is somebody who is coming to bring a message of love to everyone, And it's also called Three Kings Day, as Jenny mentioned. But the thing is, we don't know that they were kings. In fact, Magi translates to astrologer in the Greek, which makes sense. They were following a star, right? It makes a lot of sense. But it's also sometimes been translated as wise men or scholars. But we also don't know that there were actually three of them. In Matthew, there's no number. It's just that the Magi came. So there could have been six of them. There could have been 14 of them. We have no idea how many there were. Of course, there were three gifts that we know, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But we don't know that there were three givers. And here's the best bit, Jenny, that you'll like, that we don't even know that they were men, because they're not named as men. These astrologers could have been women. They could have been non-binary. We have no idea who they were. And so, of course, it's come down to us as men, because that's how stories tend to happen in our society. But we don't know that they were men, and we don't know that there were three of them even. So, but we're going to go with the translation for this talk of the Magi being astrologers who are following. The main thing is they came from afar, and they came on this arduous journey to meet this new child that was born into the world. Now, if anybody has, I know it's some people have been harmed by the institution of Christianity, and they can be put off by this. So even though my talk is framed in this language, I think the story goes much bigger than that. And personally, my practice for the last nearly 30 years has been Zen Buddhist practice. And I'm also a student of the Christian mystics. And I don't call myself a Buddhist or a Christian. I call myself somebody who follows a contemplative path, a mystic path. I want to learn from the mystics of all traditions. I follow in those footsteps. So I hope that even if you have an issue with Christianity and the institution of Christianity and the way it has been misused, I invite you to join me on this short pilgrimage today, because the reason I am drawn to this story of Epiphany around this baby Jesus is because he would grow up to be this very street smart, socially conscious, totally inclusive to everybody, mystic with a lot to teach us, regardless of the fact that his message was very much distorted and misused later by the politics of empire. So as we go on this journey today, this journey of the Magi, we're looking at it through the eyes of the poet T.S. Eliot, who wrote this poem in 1972, that would have been from beyond the grave, was written in 1927. And just after he converted from Unitarianism to the Anglican Church, he just moved to England from the USA. And he'd converted to Anglicanism, which is similar to the Episcopal Church in the USA. So within this story, there is an external story about a literal physical pilgrimage that Eliot, Thomas Stearns Eliot, is imagining to find the baby Jesus, the newborn Christ. But hidden inside that poem is also, I see it also, a kind of pathway to reflect to us the inner spiritual pilgrimage, the work on the consciousness path. And I hope as we go along here, some of this will resonate with you too, with your own experiences of your own awakenings and rebirths. So why don't we look at the poem? I did bring copies in to the to Unity, Sean did for me kindly this morning. But if you are watching online, then Sean has also put in the chat box if you know how to open the link and see that, as well as hearing me without losing us all together. Their poem is there too. And also later, there's a marvelous, marvelous recording of T.S. Eliot himself reading this poem on YouTube. So if you go in and look for T.S. Eliot reading Journey of the Magi, you'll find it, because he's got this wonderful, very old-fashioned, stentorian, masculine, white, rich kind of way of presenting it. But it's very beautiful. It makes me cry every time. So here we go. Let's look at the poem, Journey of the Magi by T.S. Eliot. And this is written, this is Eliot imagining himself as one of the Magi, having endured this arduous journey to reach this child in this stable and looking back on it from years later. A cold coming we had of it, just the worst time of the year for a journey, and such a long journey. The ways deep and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter. And the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. There were times we regretted the summer palaces on slopes, the terraces, and the silken girls bringing sherbet. Then the camel men cursing and grumbling and running away and wanting their liquor and women, and the night fires going out and the lack of shelters and the cities hostile and the towns unfriendly and the villages dirty and charging high prices. A hard time we had of it. At the end, we preferred to travel all night, sleeping in snatches, with the voices singing in our ears saying, that this was all folly. Then at dawn, we came down to a temperate valley wet below the snow line, smelling of vegetation, with a running stream and a watermill beating the darkness, and three trees on the low sky. And an old white horse galloped away in the meadow. Then we came to a tavern with vine leaves over the lintel, six hands at an open door dicing for pieces of silver, and feet kicking the empty wineskins. But there was no information, and so we continued and arrived at evening. Not a moment too soon finding the place. It was, you may say, satisfactory. All this was a long time ago. I remember, and I would do it again. But set down this. Were we led all that way for birth or death? There was a birth, certainly. We had evidence and no doubt. I had seen birth and death, but thought they were different. This birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death, our death. We returned to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here in the old dispensation with an alien people clutching their gods. I should be glad of another death. Just out of curiosity, probably the easiest thing is to raise hands or something. How many people were familiar with that poem already? Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed hearing it and reading it. I have always loved this poem since I was about 15. And at that age, it was easy for me to understand the various kind of English literature references kind of thing. So that foreshadow the crucifixion of this now child in the future. So for example, we have the three trees on the low sky, you know, which kind of foreshadow and hearken the three crosses on Golgotha where Jesus will one day be crucified. The pieces of silver remind us of Judas betraying Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. The men dicing remind us of the soldiers who diced or drew lots for Jesus's robes as he went to the crucifixion. So there's other kind of literary references in there that one can recognize. And of course, for the actual narrator, the person that's made this journey, the painful death of his or her old ways of thinking about God, as this new consciousness is born into the world. I'll come back to that in a minute. But it's only in the last couple of years that it struck me that this poem actually is something more subtle too. It's like an analogy or description of the inner path of spiritual work. So let me give you some examples of what I mean. First of all, we have a personal encounter here, right? The Magi had to go and experience Jesus, the newborn Jesus, for themselves. This new hope and love wasn't something to talk about abstractly, intellectually. It wasn't something to believe in randomly from afar, theoretically intellectualizing. It was about something they had to have a direct experience of. And in that encounter, they didn't need proof or evidence of who this child was. The nature and quality of what they experienced in that cold, shabby little stable in Bethlehem convinced them there was no doubt for them. They didn't need scientific proof. And this to me is so very much the nature of our spiritual journey. It isn't something to talk about in an intellectual debate or something to believe in abstractly because somebody's told us to, but something we directly experience through practice, through grace, and through many different doors in our life. And they also had to work quite hard to experience it. This is a tough physical journey through the physical world. It's very much about earthly troubles. You know, they're not transported for this encounter with the divine to some other realm, some elevated transcendent realm, you know, with trumpets and angels and singing and golden light and everything. They are just in this very humble, they just go to this very humble place through a lot of physical difficulties, through physical discomfort, the everyday material challenges of life. the ordeals. So they've got, you know, they've got the bad-tempered camel men running off and wanting their liquor and women, and they've got the bad-tempered camels lying down, and they're sleeping in melted cold snow. And you know, and everybody's hostile and unfriendly and ripping them off. And it's really, you know, it's happening in this physical world. And they're having to let go of the comforts of the ego, the things that they missed from home about the pretty silken girls serving up delightful drinks and treats for them. You know, they have to let go of some of their attachment to some of those things. And isn't that the journey, right? It doesn't happen in some other place. It happens right here. It requires daily intention and dedication and work and practice and letting go of some of our comfortable attachments. And well, I should have to speak for myself here. We have to practice what we preach. We have to hold to our highest good in these everyday encounters. So we run into somebody who kind of like annoys us in the supermarket, and we're in a frustrating situation where we want to lash out or kind of like bite back in some way. And then remembering the words that we sing here at Unity about let there be love on earth and let it begin with me. And you know, that's so annoying sometimes, isn't it? It's like, it's like, really? I have to do that today? I don't get a day off for good behavior. I have to find it in me now and bring it forward in me now as well. You know, I have to do love now. Okay. You know, we're in the trenches all the time, slogging through the trenches sometimes, being spat at by camels and ripped off by hostile villagers. And then within that, can we stay true to love, keep our hearts open and continue the path through all of that? And then we have to follow the star. Even though the star is not actually mentioned in Eliot's poem, we know about the star from the Gospel of Matthew, where the story is told. And I just love that. I love that image of all of us following our star. You know, what's your star? I've been thinking this. What's that? What is your star? You know, we have to follow our intuition and inner sense of direction, that inner star, to guide us and lead us on the right path. And I'm not saying make it up as you go along, because I do strongly believe that most spiritual unfolding happens better within the container of a specific practice, a teacher, a community, some specific framework to kind of hold us through. But we also need to follow our star towards the path that's calling us, right, across those wild hills. Like across those wild hills, there's that glimmer of light, and we see it, and it's like it makes part of our heart leap in the spark, and we follow it, and then we lose sight of it. It goes behind the clouds, and it's like, was it ever there? Was it ever there? And then we see it, oh, there it is, and we keep following. So I think it's that is the question that I ask myself. What is that inner star that I can follow? What is that orientation in my life? And then even as we follow the star, we have doubt. We will also hear those voices singing in our ears that Eliot describes, saying that this is all folly. And, you know, we doubt our teacher, we doubt our path, we doubt our practice, we doubt our understanding, we doubt whether this is getting us anywhere. Are we deluding ourselves? I think if you're not asking these questions sometimes and you're kind of missing something, perhaps a bit too complacent or something, I think this is very healthy questioning. In Zen practice, people talk about the importance of holding great faith and great doubt. And I really like that, because if you're 100% in faith, 100% certain all the time, then that just basically leads to fundamentalism. And if you're 100% doubting, then that leads to a kind of nihilism and secular materialism. So there's this lovely balancing act between faith and doubt, and knowing and not inner knowing and not knowing and questioning. So we listen to the voice that says, is this all folly? But then what? Then what? Then what do we do? Maybe we adjust our bearings a little, but we trust the star. We trust that star. We trust that light, and we keep walking the path toward it, lit by it. And then as we persevere on that path, we come to this fertile valley that Eliot describes below that cold snow line. It's now lush and alive with vegetation, a running stream. Out of the bitter cold and discomfort and conflicts and trials, we come to this new, alive, fertile place. And you'll notice perhaps that the majority of the poem is on the journey, not on the arriving, which is also very true, isn't it? of this spiritual path or this consciousness path, there's a lot of pilgrimage, there's a lot of practice, there's a lot of the walking, but the focus is on the way, not on the result. And I find this essential in my own practice, because not to be grasping or reaching for a result, not to be grabbing onto this awakening, this desired awakening, but just moment by moment, following the path, trusting the star during the practice. And then, you know, great humility when some realization does arrive, some awakening or insight. In this poem, that the narrator describes the discovery of the baby Jesus, the new Christ consciousness in the world, as it was, you may say, satisfactory. I mean, understatement of the millennia, but this is how he describes it. It's this very simple place. There's something very simple about the whole experience. So maybe he was expecting some big magical moment with some kind of like supernatural being sitting on a throne with a crown or something. And instead he finds the most fragile and vulnerable thing. He finds this moment that is so quiet and intimate. It's a young girl, Mary, nursing a tiny baby, a vulnerable infant who sleeps in a manger surrounded by barn animals. I mean, there is absolutely nothing grandiose in this. And so often for me, the deepest moments have kind of nudged their way into my awareness too. It's been very quiet, but at the same time, it changes everything. The awakening moment is both extraordinary, but somehow ordinary too. And usually I don't even speak of these things and to other people until months or years later, because they feel so natural and ordinary at the time. It's a case of, oh, of course, a bit like just natural, like a mother nursing a baby. It's that natural. So it's those kind of moments. Does anybody resonate with this? Those kind of moments of seeing through to the essential nature of things, those inner moments when a moment of grace arrives, but it's often in the simple, humble experiences of daily life, you know, washing the dishes or chopping the wood or something. And then there's that moment, there is that epiphany, that manifestation. And then of course we come to the death. So the death in this poem is so linked to the birth, not only in the foreshadowing of what will become of this child, but also for the narrator here, it's the death of his old tribal mentalities, these old gods. And these, we're talking about the way, you could probably argue historically about this to some degree, but the way Eliot is talking about this in this poem is talking about the old gods who kind of demanded blood sacrifice, the all-powerful, all-knowing, all-capricious and punitive god that really you kind of want to stay out of the way of. You want to stay under the radar as far as he's concerned. And if you do come to his attention, and it is always a he in this case, sadly, if you do come to his attention, then, you know, just go and slaughter a lamb, you know, and try and sort it out that way. So this is this kind of a god, this kind of old god. And some of us grew up with that image of God still, you know, unfortunately. But instead, the narrator in this poem sees a new possibility for God, not a God of power, but a God of vulnerability, simplicity, and love, something much more humble and relational. What could be easier to connect to than a tiny, fragile baby? And it strikes me that every time, you know, I have any kind of rebirth or an awakening, it's always a new insight, a new understanding. It's pretty much always accompanied by the death of something else. So it could be old beliefs, old understandings, old ideas, old structures, old stories, old sense of identity and self-image, old allegiances, even old relationships. And it can be very painful and very hard to let go of those things. I'm just checking the time here. Okay, we're good. It can be very hard to let go of those things. So for, you know, and because often they're linked to our family, our culture, our church of origin, you know, the very waters we swim in, our political system, our educational system, whatever, these old structures that sometimes have to, we have a different relationship to, these are the very waters we swim in. So it can be very painful, you know. It can mean, like Elliot, a change of religion. Now, Elliot's grandfather was a minister and a founder of a Unitarian church in St. Louis. So so for Elliot to convert from Unitarianism to the Anglican church would have been not only changing his entire religion and moving into a whole different relationship with God, but also turning away from a family legacy. And I imagine painful. And as I know, it's been for other people who felt moved to leave their church of origin, which is often entwined, as I say, with family identity, sense of belonging. And of course, our ego resists any such change and any death of any self-identity, I think, in my experience, is probably one of the hardest things. Self-identity just runs through everything we do, really. All those things that make us who we are, what we think of as an us, we tend to be very attached to that self-image, right down to the issue, the idea of who we are in a bigger sense, in the cosmic sense. You know, I've discovered through experiences that the very essence of my identity is not located in this supposedly fit self called a Tanya, you know. But that requires me to give a death to the Tanya that's quite attached to her ideas and her preferences and wants pretty much on a daily basis. Tehar de Chardin, of course, everybody knows a lot of people know the famous saying, we are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. And sometimes when that cog turns, thank you, Barbara, when that cog turns and we fully experience that, fully live that, even if it's just for a moment and then it fades away again across the hills, when that cog turns, it can be huge, you know, it can be a huge shift for people, for myself, certainly. So I know that letting go of those old identities and beliefs, those old belongings can be very painful. I've experienced it myself. And to close, I'd like to share an example of one that I've tussled with. So nearly 10 years ago, my mother disowned me and halted any relationship or communication with me. She had many inner demons that she struggles with, and she also battles with the disease of alcoholism. And since I was a child, she had clearly been ambivalent towards me and towards being a mother, you know. I was her only child, and of course, I love her very much. So it's been painful. But she had often cut off from me in the past, so before the final big cutting off. So, for example, once a year, she never spoke with me. I lived in London. We lived about an hour away from each other. She didn't speak to me for a year, didn't take my calls, didn't send me a birthday card, just no, wouldn't communicate with me at all, wouldn't open the door when I drove to her house and banged on it and said, let me in, we need to talk. Just nothing. And then one day would talk to me again for some reason I still don't understand. After I moved to the USA, I went back on a visit at her request to visit her. And on the second day of the visit, she said, I am going for a walk. And when I come back, it's best that you're not here. Took me a while to realize that she didn't just think I should go out and grab a coffee, that she wanted me to pack my bags and go on the second day. And as far as I was aware, we'd had no conflict of any kind. So it was a shock to be told to leave in such a way. These are just two examples of many. And I tell you this not to demonize my mother at all, who has many wonderful traits and who I believe is only acting out of her own hurt, but to give some very minimal context for the next piece. So finally, my mother sent me an email cutting me off 10 years ago, refused to talk to me, refused to take any calls, and that's it. We haven't had any communication. We haven't communicated since. So at this point, I had two core beliefs that I'd evolved over years of spiritual practice and consciousness work. One was that no matter how my mother treated me, I had enough love for both of us. I was the bigger person, the less wounded person, the more conscious person, the more spiritual person, and more evolved. And therefore, my love could carry both of us. Really, a huge bunch of hubris in that whole position. Let's face it, right? It was a good and sincere intention, but completely disconnected from reality, as though I controlled the universe and my mother. Actually, easier to control the universe than my mother. So great hubris in this concept. The other belief I had was that I would be the one who would heal our family's karma, because over generations, there'd been a pattern of people cutting off from each other, sibling from sibling, parent from child. People who lived in the same house didn't even talk to each other sometimes, and they lived in tiny houses for like 2 years without talking to each other. I mean, just this whole pattern, generational pattern. And I was determined that this family pattern would stop with me. Not because I don't have children. That's irrelevant. That's just too literal. You know, I meant in a bigger way, in a spiritual way, in a soulful way, this pattern would stop with me. And I would heal, in retrospect, this family karma, this cause and effect pattern that rippled through the generations by refusing to be cut off from my mother. Just refusing. Like, this is why I kept going back, you know. My father had long gone, by the way. He'd left. He was out of my life since I was 5 years old. So my mother was my only family. At this point, my beloved grandparents had died. So when my mother made this final cut 10 years ago, aside from the grief I lost, I felt in losing this primal relationship, losing my only remaining family, it also challenged all my beliefs and intentions and my very self-identity as the somewhat savior Tanya, who was going to heal the whole family karma, right? So I had enough for both of us. Why wasn't it working? You know, I had failed. I dropped the baton now and let this old story happen again. But honestly, at the same time, I was really exhausted. I was exhausted with trying. And I was just exhausted with holding up my end here, honestly. And on the last visit I'd seen her, she'd physically attacked my husband. She had been, just by email in person, very vicious and cruel to me, letting me know just what a shameful specimen of a human I was in her eyes, nothing to redeem me at all. And I was exhausted, you know, I just thought, okay. I was just defeated, honestly. I couldn't do it anymore. And I didn't have any option anyway. She wouldn't take my phone calls, and I lived 6,000 miles away from her. So I painfully, as well as grieving the actual relationship, I also had to painfully and reluctantly let go of that old self-image, this Tanya, who is bigger, who has enough love, who could hold everything. And as Elliot said, it was a defeat. It was a hard and bitter agony. Honestly, it really felt like that. That was a big part of the pain. But as time went on and I worked with this more, I realized that actually I hadn't failed in those intentions if I looked at it through another way. And I'm not spiritual bypassing here, to put a pretty gloss on it, because I also deeply still do feel the grief and loss of my mother. I miss her. You know, there were great elements to her. So I still miss her. So I'm not bypassing the human reality of losing my mother. But on another level, I realized that there was a new birth of something that was different, and those core beliefs were still manifesting in a way I hadn't anticipated. So I discovered that, I actually do have enough love for both of us, but I don't have to be in contact with her to experience that. My life has kind of blossomed in very many ways since I withdrew that energy from her and put it into my own life on a psychic, energetic kind of level. And my image of who I am in the universe has become infinitely bigger, infinitely more expansive. Things have shifted enormously, and I can't take credit for that. This is just part of a process that happened, you know. I mean, I did the work, but, you know, we're still graced, right? And I hope that she is flourishing now too, that she doesn't have to force a relationship with me. I suspect that she felt bad about the way she treated me, and that fed into her own pain and kept adding to her inner demons, beating herself up maybe. And then it came out on me. I don't know. This is pure projection. I really can't say. But I'm hoping that in the separation of me not trying to force this relationship that was clearly unwelcome, perhaps she has more peace in her heart now too. And I do know for sure that my love has grown, without any need of receiving anything from her. And within that, it's so hard to explain, friends. It really is, but it's, I still within that feel that I am actually healing the family karma, but in, again, not in the way I anticipated. It comes more from living a life that is rich and full of love and overflowing with grace, really. And I believe that like a fountain that keeps going. And I believe that that overflow flows back to my ancestors of previous generations. I feel like this is also happening on a bigger plane, in a bigger reality than just this Tanya sitting in this chair. But I share this example to close because I know I'm not the only one who has had painful separations from people they love. And perhaps you can relate to some of this kind of death of self-identity or self-image, and then which then flowers into a new epiphany, a kind of a rebirth or awakening. But so just at this time of epiphany, I invite you, if any of this resonates, to think about sometimes when something feels like a death, a bitter agony, a letting go that's not wanted at the time, that perhaps it is part of this journey towards a new birth that will bring, you know, a completely new consciousness into your world, into your life, and into everyone you touch around you. Thank you.
Thank you, Tanya.
Yeah. Thank you, Tanya.
Let's hope we can do that. We all have those challenges.
Denny, are you sure your microphone is actually on? Very little.
There is love on earth, and it has begun with me. Now there is love on earth, the love that was meant to be. With all our relations, loved ones all are we. Now I walk with my family in perfect harmony. Love has begun with me, and this is the moment now. With every breath I take, let this be my joyous vow. To take each moment and live each moment in love eternally. Now there is love on earth, and it has begun with me. We are the light, the love, and the presence. Wherever we are, love is, and all is well. Yay. Thank you so much, everybody. Love you. We'll have Richard Rubin talking about rewilding your beautiful space next week. Thank you, Tanya.